Off the ball. Rugby.
Yeah, they're very, very helpful players if you have them. But there's no young fellas in there that you're kind of... Mac Hansen is obviously much younger. His football nous is pretty high.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
You're listening to OTB's Breakfast Bite. Yeah!
We want to talk a little bit about what might happen at Munster if a scenario evolves where Jack Crowley is actually leaving as opposed to just using the public megaphone to get more money. Mike Sherry is with us this morning. Mike, good morning to you.
Morning, guys.
Hey,
You're obviously very connected to the club game. We've established this over the last couple of months. What are you hearing from dyed-in-the-wool Munster rugby people about the potential of Jack Crowley leaving? How would they feel if this did happen?
They would feel devastated. It would be an absolute nightmare. Speaking as a fan, former player, someone who's connected to the game, as you mentioned there, it would be a disaster if Jack was to leave. I think he's had a rough couple of months. I think that's obvious for everyone to see. Yes, Ireland have had a project and a plan in place to build depth, but I think the victim of that has been Jack. And probably played on his mind. I struggle to see how he went into this Six Nations without this locked off. So poor planning on the RFU's behalf on that side of things, or maybe it was Jack's idea or his agent's idea to go into the Six Nations. Maybe seeing the writing on the wall and predicting that there might have been a big deal being offered coming down the line. So the numbers that are being mentioned, it's very hard to completely turn your nose up at that. Jack isn't the type of guy that would be dragging this out for the sake of it. I think it's genuine at this stage. I think there's no getting around that. And I think the knock-on effect from all the way down Ireland, Munster, would be a disaster. Yeah, he's your marquee player for the next 10 years. He's the guy to step in and be the... It's not even the heir apparent now at this stage to O'Gara, but the next kind of homegrown, through the club game, through the schools game, up through the academy, getting his opportunity with Munster, knowing what it means to him, getting up through the Irish setup, and he'll be your guy that you're banking on week in, week out for the big games. And to lose him at this stage of his career after just turning 25, I think would be a media disaster for the RFU and for rugby as a whole in the island. It would be really detrimental.
Mike, if you were Jack Crowley, what would you do?
I would stay, but that's very easy for me to say. I would stay. I think the offer he's going to get from the RFU or has gotten from the RFU will be a good one. There's no doubt about that. It probably won't come near, if the numbers are real, of what Leicester have put in front of him. But for me, he's the starting Ireland 10 when it comes to the two Six Nations leading into the World Cup. And I think he's the starting 10 come the World Cup. And look, you can pick up a lot of money from international rugby win bonuses, competition win bonuses, all that type of stuff. So he could pick up a sizable amount on that side of things to supplement the contract that the RFU have put in front of him. And I think this is where his heart is at. I think going to Leicester, he'd give it his all. He'd be a brilliant signing for them, but I don't think it would fulfill playing for Ireland, playing for Munster, going for a trophy with both those teams like it would over there.
You think he's starting 10 for the next couple of Six Nations. But what if he isn't, I suppose, in this world and he stays? Do you think there's an element of regret then?
Yeah, I do. And that's the really tricky one for Jack. The reason I say I think he's the starting 10 is I just think he's too good a player. I think his form will come through. I think he'll start showing for Munster now between the end of the season. Who knows with the Lions? There's bolters. I don't know if Jack would be a bolter, but given the last couple of months, it would be a bit of a surprise. But he could play himself in there through Munster form. And then, yeah, I think he'll be starting. But look, as I said, it's really easy for me to sit here and say that. That's life-changing money that's been put in front of him. And it is really, really hard to think about it coldly and say, look, what if I start for Ireland next year? I'm sure his agent is saying And rightfully so, his agent is saying to him, well, what if you don't? Just be sure that you're prepared to forego this 100, 200, 300K differential.
We were talking about a bunch of different things there, but one of them is peak football. And actually, in fairness, Harry Kane is saying that no one's listening to the footballers complaining about the fact that there's too much football. You've written about this a little bit, just that, and it's not so much too much football as that the football, too much of the football doesn't actually matter, in particular World Cup qualifiers when it comes to nations like, for example, England.
Yeah, I mean, I know England are in a privileged position here. So I was writing this piece partly, you know, as a reaction to England's two qualifiers against Albania and Latvia. But also, I think, because it represents something more common in the modern game, which is that we seem to have this dynamic where, at least for the teams who hope to win things, lots of the games just sort of pass by. It's not really a challenge, not really a test. They're sort of non-events. And then you suddenly, the step up to as you get to the end of that tournament is enormous. So the way the World Cup now is with 48 teams, you know, whether England would have been saying this 20 years ago when they, you know, they're struggling to qualify for the Euros, maybe not. But you look at that group, the hardest team England have to play between now and the World Cup is Serbia, who are ranked 32 in the world. Now, obviously, they can arrange friendlies, and to an extent, this is their own fault because if they'd been in League A of the Nations League, they would have had the quarterfinals of that last weekend, and then potentially they'd have been playing, you know, with, you know, Germany and Portugal and Spain and France in the finals in the summer. But the fact they don't, the only challenge they're going to have is those friendlies, and then you get to the World Cup. Dilution of quality with 48 teams. Chances are the group will be fairly straightforward. You'd have to be pretty unlucky to get a good side in the last 32. Even last 16, you might dodge one. So England could potentially have 16 months of playing, I don't know, what would that be, a dozen, maybe 14, 15 games that don't really mean anything, don't have anything really riding on them, that aren't a challenge. And then suddenly, bang, they run into a France or a Spain or a Brazil or an Argentina in the quarterfinal. And I think if you look at the Champions League, it's a similar dynamic that, say, Bayern, I mean, it's less so for Premier League clubs, but for Bayern, and last year is an exception, they sort of wander through their league. It's not really much of a challenge. They don't have to do much defending. And then suddenly quarterfinal of the Champions League, bang, here's a good side. And it's really difficult for them. And I don't think it's good for those clubs. I don't think it's good for football generally. And it's... This isn't the first time I've thought this, but it genuinely baffles me that England get 80,000 for every single one of these games at Wembley. Who on earth is going? Okay, 20,000, 25,000 Albanians went to that game. But it's not just the expat communities in London. People that go in to watch this football, which, to be honest, doesn't really resemble football. It's one team sitting in a very deep block, England incredibly slowly working their way through it. And then everybody's trying to go, oh, they move the ball a bit slowly, they need to move the ball quick. Well, they probably do, but also, what's the point of learning how to do that? Because that's not real football. They win these games 2 or 3 nil anyway. And that, you know, being able to beat them 6 or 7 nil doesn't really make any difference for the challenge of winning the World Cup. So I sort of think it's two things have happened. So the bloating of tournaments has led to the devaluing of qualification easier, to the point that it almost, for an England or a Germany or a Spain, feels a formality. It dilutes the quality then at the major tournament, once you get to the finals, but also the financial stratification of football in the club game. You know, I mean, Bayern, to carry on with them as an example, their revenues are more than 50% higher than the next biggest team in the Bundesliga. So, of course, they sort of cruise through the league and then suddenly run into big teams in the quarterfinals. So the problem is that sort of mid-ranking games, that from an England point of view, you look at, you know, 1994, when they don't qualify for the World Cup, they have to play Poland, a good Norway, and the Netherlands. So one really big team and two really difficult teams. 98 World Cup, they had Italy and Poland. 2002 World Cup, they had Germany, a decent Greece, and Ukraine. And that sort of mid-tier game has now become the hardest game. And that, I think, is a big problem for football.
To listen to this morning's Off The Ball Breakfast in full, become a member at offtheball.com/join now.